Stifel Nicolaus, I am committed to offering investors personalized investment guidance. Stifel has a full-service organization with departments staffed with professionals that specialize in a wide range of investment opportunities. We strive to give each account, regardless of size, careful individual attention. This is Susan Eastman, financial advisor, Stifel Nicolaus. Let's talk today about a personalized plan. Give me a call at 530-244-7199. Again, 530-244-7199.
For over 50 years, House of Realty has provided experienced and effective advice to its real estate clients. Experts in residential, commercial, and investment property, we have the knowledge and tools to assist you with all of your real estate needs. Family owned and operated since 1965, we have been an active part of the Shasta County community for generations. Please call House of Realty today at 241-8300, a reputation for excellence since 1965.
From the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
I find it amusing that anyone would propose moving elections to a single day after the impetus, particularly on the left, has been to stretch out the election process over weeks of early voting. And, you know, that may have been a factor in the elections process in 2020.
This is your host, Scott Bertram. Welcome to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, part of the Hillsdale College Podcast Network. That was Dr. Kevin Porteous, professor of politics and director of American Studies at Hillsdale College. We talk with him today about the how and why we nominate our presidential candidates in the way that we do. Dr. Porteous, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's good to have you back. Today we talk about the how and the why and the history of the way we get our presidential nominees, as that season is coming upon us very quickly. We go way back. The Constitution itself is silent on not the nominating process for candidates. The framers didn't really anticipate political parties developing, in fact. So how did this process emerge in the early days of the country?
Well, as you point out, the founders hadn't really anticipated that there would be a parties or a partisan system. And so as parties developed in the 1790s, ultimately what you ended up with was a system whereby an organization or a party, and the parties at this time were nothing like the parties we have today. They were very Congress-centered. They were not grassroots. The members of Congress from the Federalist and Democratic Republican parties would get together in what was called a caucus, and they would select presidential candidates, especially the Democratic Republican Party. They had a very heavy emphasis on this. And that lasted really up through James Monroe, and then it began to break down, and you started to get the development of a more modern party system with a more bottom-up organization.
Since the presidency of Andrew Jackson or so, party conventions have been the avenue through which candidates for president are chosen. How do those conventions function maybe prior to that, and when did we begin to transition to the use of state primaries and state caucuses?
Well, from about the 1830s on, you began to have these conventions at all levels, local, state, federal, and it was really kind of a representative process whereby more local parties would select candidates and write platforms at the local level and then send delegates to a state convention. And the state convention would do the same thing, and then it would elect delegates to send to a national convention from that state. And so what you got was a process whereby the party membership was indirectly represented in the national conventions, and they would meet, and sometimes those delegates would be pledged and to a particular candidate, and sometimes they wouldn't be, but oftentimes that pledging only lasted for one ballot. And so if the first ballot did not produce a winner, then the delegates were released and could vote their own consciences, could make deals, whatever they had to do. The transition to a primary system is actually very slow and gradual. You get your first primaries around the beginning of the 20th century, and it was very much a progressive reform. The progressives believed that the convention system was too boss-dominated, too mm-hmm. insider-dominated, and their goal was to make the political system more closely tied to and more accountable to the people.
If we move forward through the 20th century and look toward the 1968 Democratic Convention, remembered for a number of different reasons, but it also helped to transform the process for nominating the president. How so?
Well, over the course of the first two-thirds of the 20th century, you had a kind of hybrid system. A few states used the primary system, but most did not. And those primaries were not necessarily binding on delegates from those states. So it was more of a preference primary, and it might influence what the delegates do at convention, mm-hmm. but it didn't necessarily bind them. And so, for instance, in 1912, Theodore Roosevelt won the few primaries in the Republican Party that existed at that time, but the convention then renominated William Howard Taft, and so this was the impetus for TR to break away and form the Progressive Party, which of course was ultimately defeated, but probably helped to elect Woodrow Wilson as a Democrat. By 1968, about a third of states used primaries. And in the Democratic Party, those states were overwhelmingly won by Bobby Kennedy. But at the end of the day, the nomination went to Hubert Humphrey mm-hmm. in a kind of settlement at the convention. This was a very contested convention. It was a very tumultuous convention with riots and police involvement. And the Democratic Party took notice. And so they appointed a commission initially under George McGovern, and then later under Congressman Donald Fraser, which recommended reforms to the process, and specifically that the process should be, quote, open, timely, and representative. And that really was the catalyst for the transformation from a few states having non-binding primaries to most, if not all, states using binding primaries, and eventually reinstituting the winner-take-all system that most states or many states employ today.
The system that essentially we have today, one of the most notable dates is what's called Super Tuesday. What is that for those who might not know, and how did that important date on the calendar originate and evolve?
Well, elections in the United States are traditionally held on Tuesdays, starting with the date set for presidential elections under the Constitution. For general elections under the Constitution, of course, the Constitution takes no notice of primary elections. But you began to have states grouping themselves together in order to maximize their influence in the process. And this is something that's happened very irregularly because, again, at the state level, primary dates shift. They're not set permanently mm-hmm. In the way that, say, a general presidential election is set by constitutional law. And so over time, you'll have two, you'll have three, but Super Tuesday simply indicates a day when a number of states have their primaries at the same time. And this is something that really got rolling in the 1980s. And eventually in that process, particularly southern states began to pool themselves together in order to maximize their influence, but it's become more than that. Mm-hmm. And so again, you may have one, two, even three of these Super Tuesdays, but the idea is these are dates when a lot of delegates are decided all at once.
Talking with Dr. Kevin Porteous about the how and the why and how it evolved, how we choose our presidential candidates for president. So in designing the calendar of the primary, how much say does the party itself have? Do the states themselves have any influence on where they are placed inside this primary schedule?
Yeah, it's a complicated process, and it varies greatly by state because the parties at the national level seek to establish a primary schedule. But ultimately, decisions about when primary elections, like all other elections in a state, will be held are set by state law. Now, states tend to go with what the party wants. Of course, the Democrats and the Republicans overwhelmingly control the state governments, and so there's a relationship there. But it's not automatic that the state simply does whatever it wants, and the parties themselves don't simply have control over the process. There's mm-hmm. there's a back and forth there in that decision making.
Dr. Porteous, hold on there. We'll come back and continue this conversation in a moment about how and why we nominate our presidential candidates here in the U.S. That's Dr. Kevin Porteous here at Hillsdale College. While we have a moment, we say hello and welcome to our affiliate in San Antonio, Texas. That's 9:30 a.m. The Answer. Thank you for tuning in to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. If you want to find a list of radio stations carrying the show across the country, go to radiohour.hillsdale.edu and click on Affiliate List. That's radiohour.hillsdale.edu. While you're there, you also can sign up to receive an email every time there's a new episode of the program. Click on subscribe and enter your email address at radiohour.hillsdale.edu. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Every day, your life is filled with choices. And when a health crisis happens, you need to be prepared to choose the best healthcare partner. That's when Shasta Regional Medical Center is there to answer the call above the rest. Ranked best in Reading and in the nation for patient safety and clinical excellence, you can be confident that when you choose Shasta, you are choosing superior care, safety, and excellence for you and your family. Choose Shasta at ShastaRegional.com.
Do you have something you'd like to get painted? Then bring it to Victory Powder Coating. Powder coating is a durable, colorful, environmentally friendly alternative to paint. It's useful in automotive, agricultural, decorative, and high-temperature applications. Victory Powder Coating has become the North State leader in powder coating applications and metal finishing. They specialize in large industrial items like truck beds, agricultural equipment, and trailers. They're dedicated to providing superior work and outstanding customer care. Consider Victory Powder Coating for your next project. Victory Powder Coating.
Alan Gordon, Coachmaster Collision. Although Coachmaster is recognized as the authority and specialist in frame and suspension, we are primarily your auto body and truck collision repair center. This includes all vehicles, Lexus, Honda, or pickup trucks. Our technicians are highly trained and have the most advanced equipment to ensure a complete and quality repair. With our knowledge and the insurance claim process, all we need is your claim number to handle your claim. Coachmaster has a great working relationship with all insurance companies. This ensures a complete repair with quality parts and a delay-free process. At Coachmaster, in our 50 years in business, we've experienced almost every situation imaginable in a claim. This experience and personal dedication to the repair of your vehicle sets Coachmaster apart from all other choices. And yes, if we can't fix it, no one can.
Learn more online at CoachmasterAutobody.com.
When people ask me for a recommendation for a heating or air conditioning company, I always say Alliance Heating and Air. Why? Well, they've been taking care of our HVAC system for 14 years. Professional, friendly, and willing to go to the extra step for their customers. I have found no problem too difficult or too minor for them to repair. I recommend Alliance Heating and Air with no reservations. You can reach them at 530-221-2642 or online at homecomfort.org. And they have 24/7 emergency assistance. Alliance Heating and Air.
Hi, this is Elle. Join me and my good friends and co-hosts Ron Lim and Lenny Matthews for our show Ask Elle right here on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM. Every Tuesday night at 6 p.m. we'll be exploring powerful topics on how to have a successful and satisfying relationship. See you here on Tuesday night at 6 p.m. brought to you by KNS Staffing Solutions.
530-605-4517.
This is Carl Bott and Ted Leidy. We want to invite you to our new show, Man Up, the fourth Thursday of each month, right here on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM.
Man Up, 6 to 7 p.m., where we explore the lost art of being a man.
Spirits, cigars, and hit the ground running when you get up in the morning. That's what Man Up's going to be about.
Oh, don't forget motorcycles, guns, and hard work every day.
And those things that men talk about when women aren't around.
That's right. Even cooking sometimes.
Even cooking sometimes. People, places, and things.
Serving your family, your community, and your country.
Man Up. Fourth Thursday of each month from 6 to 7 p.m. right here on Free Fire Radio.
ExecutionMinute.com.
We're back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertrand. We've been talking with Dr. Kevin Porteous, Professor of Politics and Director of American Studies at Hillsdale College, about the why and how we nominate our presidential candidates here in the U.S. Dr. Porteous, in 2016, perhaps most notably that year, the Democratic Party got caught up in a controversy or discussion around, surrounding the superdelegates. What are superdelegates? Why did only the Democratic Party have them, and what's their current role in that system?
So the superdelegates arose as a result of concerns among Democratic Party insiders about the reforms that were implemented as a result of the McGovern-Fraser Commission. The McGovern-Fraser Commission put the nominating process very much in the hands of the party's activist class and of its voting base. And there was concern there that decisions were not being made on the basis of factors like electability. And so in the mid-1970s, the Democratic Party instituted the superdelegate feature, which basically means that a certain percentage of the delegates to the convention are essentially party insiders. So if you're a member of Congress from the Democratic Party, if you are a former or sitting vice president, you have one of these seats. If you are a member of the Democratic National Committee, right? If you're one of these insiders, you have the inside track to these slots. And the number varies, but it's basically about 15 to 20%. And the concern in 2016 was that the superdelegates were all throwing in behind Hillary Clinton and making it very, very difficult for anyone to challenge from the grassroots, in this case Bernie Sanders, whom the party wanted. And so there were some reforms after 2016 that the Democrats had a commission, 2017, 2018, and they reduced the number of superdelegates somewhat, but they also decided that superdelegates would not vote on the first ballot in the convention, so that superdelegates are now only going to become an issue if the first ballot does not produce a winner, and that first ballot is dominated by the results of the primary process.
Are those superdelegates the only significant way in which the two major parties sort of differ in the way that they nominate those candidates these days?
Well, the Republicans do have some seats set aside for party insiders, a few per state, but the number is far less in the Republican Party, and so they have proven to be less of an issue. And the Republican Party primary processes have not been as close as the Democrats were necessarily in 2016. Mm-hmm. Even in 2016 for the Republicans, by the time you got to the end of that process, it was Trump and Ted Cruz, and Trump was clearly ahead. And so they weren't poised to be a decisive factor.
Talking with Dr. Kevin Porteous about the why and the how we nominate our candidates for president. This cycle, the Democrats have changed the primary calendar, replacing Iowa, which recently has been first, with South Carolina. Why would they do something like that? What's the significance of a change like that in the process?
Yeah, they've actually moved to limit the importance of both Iowa and New Hampshire. And the White House itself has promoted South Carolina and Georgia. Now, of course, South Carolina was the state that put Biden in the driver's seat in 2020. Biden's campaign was not doing great up until that point, but scored a very decisive victory in South Carolina. And I think the reason for the biggest reason for that change is that by Democratic Party standards, Iowa and New Hampshire are simply unrepresentative. Mm-hmm. Iowa is going increasingly red. It's joining Ohio in that sense and becoming a more decisively Republican state. But I think more importantly in both cases, those two states are overwhelmingly white. Mm-hmm. And that means that they are not representative. And South Carolina and Georgia are more diverse in that regard. And so, again, by Democratic Party standards, that means that they are more representative of the Democratic Party's electorate and significant, signifying the importance, as the Biden people understand, of the black vote in driving Biden's nomination.
Not to get too technical here, but I mean, New Hampshire or Iowa, the states themselves could say, well, forget that. We're still going to go first. But the parties that have mechanisms to punish those states, generally with taking away or lessening the delegates they have available to pledge at the convention, right?
Yeah, and that's a double-edged sword, because parties do have that weapon, which is to say they can look at Iowa's delegates and say, you know what? You're not going to count as much because you broke our rules, right? The Iowa state caucus process broke Democratic Party rules. We said South Carolina was going to go first. You decided you were going to go first anyway. The other side of that is that parties are loath to sort of diminish delegates from a particular state, or to not certify delegates, or to do anything like that that's going to open up the party to the charge that they are being unrepresentative. So there's a little bit of a mutual assured destruction aspect to it, which is to say the state and the parties, right, each of them have cards to play, but there's sort of risks involved on either side. And so the parties tried, especially recently, to try and use that mechanism, but ultimately it did not prove particularly successful.
There's been some discussion or conversation, or at least proposals, to move to a single day national primary. States who vote later, those voters say, well, by the time we vote, you know, the candidate we want is gone. It's already decided. Are there any advantages to, say, the parties themselves to say, okay, let's do it all on a day across the country? And would it be better for our elections overall as a country to say, we're all going to do this together on the same day?
Well, at least as far as the general election was concerned, that was the idea. And so I find it amusing that anyone would propose moving elections to a single day after the impetus, particularly on the left, has been to stretch out the election process over weeks of early voting. And, you know, that may have been a factor in the elections process in 2020, because there are people out there who cast their vote early and then, you know, additional information comes out, but it's already too late for them. And so, you know, I can see the value. If you're going to select your candidates by primary, I can certainly see the value of doing it nationwide on a certain day. That way, all of the voters in one party or the other are making their decisions based on a common set of information. But it's never going to happen in practice, because, again, with early voting and vote by mail, the idea of voting on a single day is just disintegrating in principle nationwide.
Dr. Kevin Porteous, professor of politics and director of American Studies here at Hillsdale College, as we talk about the way we nominate our candidates for president. Dr. Porteous, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you.
Up next, we talk with J. Michael Waller. His brand new book is Big Intel: How the CIA and FBI Went from Cold War Heroes to Deep State Villains. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
When it comes to dinner, you're looking for tasty, flavor, ample portions, choices, and great value in a cozy, clean, family-friendly environment. Guests tell us our home-style dinners deliver on all counts. Whether you choose chicken fried steak, house-made meatloaf, roasted turkey, or slow-cooked pot roast, you'll be full and satisfied in the best way possible. So make Black Bear Diner your January comfort dinner destination. Open daily at 2605 Hilltop Drive, Reading.
Black Bear Diner. Founded in 1995, GI Pathology is the only physician-owned laboratory in the United States dedicated solely to the practice of gastrointestinal and liver pathology. The company provides the highest quality GI pathology diagnosis made exclusively by one of our fellowship-trained gastrointestinal and liver pathologists. GI Pathology delivers results to its Northern California client base within an industry-leading 24 hours. Call 888-2-GI-PATH or go to www.gipath.com for more information.
Hi, this is Chuck Kenny with Shasta Gas Propane. It's been a while since I've cut a new radio spot, but I feel I need to issue a warning about energy prices during this fall winter. Just as Obama said after he was elected, elections have consequences. This winter, our country will suffer some of the consequences of the last election. I'm not a politician, but I am a businessman, and many of the decisions of this current administration will drastically affect energy prices this winter and going forward. Already, we are experiencing record-high propane costs and prices. Remember, our motto at Shasta Gas Propane is, "Our customers are warm friends." We will treat you like friends this winter and do our best to help you through this high-priced winter. Give us a call at 365-3793. That's 365-3793.
Welcome to the Queen of Dragons Dispensary, your ultimate destination for top-notch cannabis experiences. Conveniently located at 5044 Shasta Dam Boulevard, Shasta Lake, our locally owned and operated dispensary takes pride in providing you with the best in price, value, and safety. Rest easy knowing that all of our products are rigorously tested for your peace of mind. We champion medical freedom, empowering you to choose what's right for you. Unbelievable value for unbeatable quality. For exclusive deals and exciting updates, don't forget to follow us on Twitter at the Queen Dragons or visit www.queenofdragons.com. The Queen of Dragons Dispensary, where the fire of quality meets the freedom of choice. Backed by popular demand, fresh and local flower powered by Pinnacle, Shasta County's premier local cultivator. Package fresh and daily with a wide variety and best prices and deals in town. And they can package larger sizes and quantities on site. Available only at the Queen of Dragons Dispensary. Winter hours are Monday through Sunday, 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. and they deliver. 530-276-9771.
Linda Fott. Join me for the first Thursday of every month at 6 p.m. for my show, North State Now. In this one-hour show, we cover what's happening in the music scene, theater, food, and arts. We get in-depth interviews with local business owners, musicians, actors, and authors. Listen in, tune in, call in, participate. Win tickets to concerts and theater productions. It's a lot of fun, and believe me, it keeps us going. Join me, your host, Linda Fott, or North State Now, the first Thursday, right here on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM, also streaming at KCNR1460.com.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertrand. Be sure to follow the show on X, formerly Twitter. We're at Hillsdale Radio. We're joined now by J. Michael Walter. He is a senior analyst for strategy at the Center for Security Policy and president of Georgetown Research, a private intelligence company in Washington, D.C. Also extensive contacts with the FBI and CIA and an asset for the CIA for a time. He'll tell us more about his experience momentarily. The brand new book is out now, Big Intel, How the CIA and FBI Went from Cold War Heroes to Deep State Villains. Michael, thanks so much for joining us.
It's great to be with you, Scott.
I briefly mentioned your background, Michael, but when people pick up the book, they will understand the detail of the reporting and writing that went into Big Intel and the history of these organizations. What is your background in intelligence, the FBI, the CIA, to be able to write something like this?
Well, my background is a kind of unusual one because people who knew me when I was just starting out in college thought that I didn't have the temperament to fit into a bureaucracy and that I was too conservative to be welcome in one. And in the words of the great Angelo Codevilla, he was a Senate staffer, then he told me, "You will hate them and they will hate you." So I ended up being an asset for CIA Director Bill Casey when I was still a college student down during the wars in Central America. So that was my entry into the intelligence world. And even though I was never part of the machine itself, I worked with it and around it for quite a long time.
As I mentioned, Big Intel is a bit of a history of these organizations, and we don't have the time right now to go into all those details, but people will find that when they pick up the book. Where do the FBI and the CIA begin? What causes their creation, and sort of what is the initial goal of those organizations?
Well, the FBI was created by a bureaucratic fiat to respond to anarchist terrorism and to certain crimes that were not handled by the states. And so you had, you know, President McKinley was assassinated by anarchists. Teddy Roosevelt was shot. You had bombings, all sorts of waves of terrorism here in the early 1900s. And so the Bureau of Investigation was created, later became a Federal Bureau of Investigation. But its first big work was really to hunt down communist radicals and deport undesirable foreigners.
Big Intel is the new book from J. Michael Waller, How the CIA and FBI Went from Cold War Heroes to Deep State Villains. People who know the FBI or know a little about the FBI certainly know the name J. Edgar Hoover. You spend time on him in the book. Tell us how Hoover helped shape the organization. And also, you say that he saw a little of this present day, of these present day problems coming. How so?
Well, Hoover warned about this. He was almost a prophet in a political sense. He really was. When he was in his 20s, he was put in charge of what was called the Radical Division of the Justice Department, and that was to hunt down communists and anarchists because he could see what was happening. So when he was in his 20s, he was running raids. He was running, setting up databases and all of these other things to start out to enable our country to defend itself internally. This was right after World War One, and so when he was put in charge of the Bureau of Investigation, he built upon that, and the Bureau's job was really to stop communist and other subversive infiltration of our country from abroad. So he could see coming what we now have thrust on us, which is this critical theory, cultural Marxism, penetration of all of our institutions by Marxists and people who don't believe in the American way of life. And he was warning about this he was warning about it 100 years ago.
You say in Big Intel that diversity, equity, and inclusion, DEI, is now essentially standard ideology through the FBI and CIA. What do you mean by that, and how has it affected the operations?
Yes, DEI was declared mission critical. That's the term, mission critical, by the FBI and CIA, meaning that DEI is a core of the mission of the FBI and of our whole, not just the CIA, but the whole intelligence community. This was a gradual infiltration, kind of like if you let rust take over your car without treating it. And you don't notice it at first, and then you think you'll take care of it later, and you don't notice till the thing starts falling apart that it's actually fallen apart and it's really too late to fix it. And that's what's happened with the FBI and CIA, where the CIA was always a liberal institution, but it was still anti-communist. It was still pro-American. FBI generally leaned somewhat conservative, but was generally, with exceptions, apolitical. But then when DEI or the elements of DEI started creeping in, it started under George W. Bush after 9/11, but it really took force when Barack Obama issued executive orders to make DEI part of the operating system of the entire U.S. government, including the intelligence community. So it was the Office of Director of National Intelligence, Clapper, and CIA Director Brennan, who really imposed it with a vengeance on the whole intelligence community.
Was this an active or passive change in the organizations? Meaning, was someone or someone's pushing for these changes throughout the organizations, or did it happen because no one stepped up to stop it?
It was both. It started out from below. We're sort of small cell groups organizing at the lower levels, among different agencies and in the private sector, came straight out of the universities. But those small cell groups really had nowhere to go and nowhere to advance until there was somebody at the top to pull them up. And that's when the Obama team came in and pulled them up from below. So they already had their different identity group cells at the lower level. Those people were then elevated to become supervisors and administrators and top managers. But for the most part, you had Republicans and conservatives looking the other way. They didn't want to see it. They didn't want to deal with it. Nothing was done. So from Trump to Obama to Bush to Biden, you have a continuum that was uninterrupted.
What tangible results or what tangible changes do you think we've seen from these new efforts inside the FBI, CIA? How do we know it's affected their work?
Oh, it severely affected their morale. I interviewed a lot of former agents and analysts and others who didn't want to be named for fear of retribution, but they left out of sheer demoralization. I talked to a former station chief in a very significant country where we had a lot of conflicts in the area, and he quit before his retirement time because he just couldn't stand it anymore. This was a case where you're being disciplined because you're using the wrong pronouns. That your promotions are weighted on whether or not you are a good DEI agent of change.
J. Michael Waller is with us. His new book is Big Intel, How the CIA and FBI Went from Cold War Heroes to Deep State Villains. The last portion of Big Intel is recommendations on how to fix the FBI and CIA. And you begin that section by saying, we can do it because it's been done before. What can we learn from the past?
Well, here's the thing. The CIA and the FBI have these brands, and that we can't get rid of the CIA. We can't get rid of they're so important. No, they're just bureaucracies. They're just brands. They have one's an agency. It's like the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency or the Bureau of Indian Affairs or Bureau of Land Management. Well, the other's just a bureau, which is even lower on the totem pole than an agency. So we can make things different the way it was done right after World War II. We can do that again. We didn't do it after 9/11. It was just President Bush just slapped together a giant Department of Homeland Security and centralized all the intelligence agencies. We had 17 of them separate so that none of them would get too powerful. He centralized them to make a huge, giant, powerful one, Department of Homeland Security plus ODNI. So we had two centralized ones. So history shows we can take these apart and take the important functions and transfer them to existing agencies that already perform those functions or have a lot smaller, leaner, much more effective intelligence community that serves the national interest without abusing the public.
J. Michael Waller, Senior Analyst for Strategy at the Center for Security Policy, President of Georgetown Research, and his new book is Big Intel, How the CIA and FBI Went from Cold War Heroes to Deep State Villains, a great history of intelligence in the country, and then a look at what's happening today. Michael, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Scott, it was great to be here.
Up next, we talk with Haley Strack, a 2023 graduate of Hillsdale College and a William F. Buckley Fellow in Political Journalism at National Review. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
This Hawaiian mini vacation is brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. So what does professional office cleaning have to do with relaxing in a tropical paradise? Frankly, nothing. But Maui Bob and the crew want to remind you to be sure to take the time for what's important in this workaday world. Family, friends, and yes, even yourself. And if their professional office cleaning services can help you make that time, give them a call at 221-5868. This Hawaiian mini vacation was brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, 221-5868.
Hi, Hi friends, RC here, bringing you this month's Cigar of the Humidor, the Diesel Vintage. A smooth burn, a perfect draw, and flavor for days. This is what an expertly crafted Parejo from the farms of AJ Fernandez offers us. The Diesel Vintage is everything we seek in a fine and exceptional cigar experience. Get yours today at Tobacco and Brew, Redding, California.
For over 50 years, House of Realty has provided experienced and effective advice to its real estate clients. Experts in residential, commercial, and investment property, we have the knowledge and tools to assist you with all of your real estate needs. Family owned and operated since 1965, we have been an active part of the Shasta County community for generations. Please call House of Realty today at 241-8300. A reputation for excellence since 1965.
I'm celebrating local heroes. Tune in the second Thursday each month at 6.05 p.m. right after the news for Heroes of the North State on North State Now. I'm Michelle Slade. During North State Now, we will speak with your neighbors, friends, family, and community members who give back, not to be recognized, but because it's the right thing to do. During these conversations, we will learn what truly makes our community and the people in it. Join me the second Thursday of each month at 6.05 p.m., right after the news, for Heroes of the North State on North State Now.
Good morning, Reading. This is Rick Hughes, host of The Flatline. Heard every Sunday morning on KCNR 96.5 FM at 7 a.m. in the morning. Just want you to know that God has given us two ends, one to think with and one to sit on. And success in life depends on which one you use. It's heads you win and tails you lose. Come join me on The Flatline and learn about God's tremendous problem-solving device. 7 a.m. every Sunday morning, 96.5 FM, KCNR.
JenMinute.com.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Be sure to check out the Hillsdale College Podcast Network at podcast.hillsdale.edu. Find older episodes of this program plus many other audio shows from Hillsdale at podcast.hillsdale.edu. We're joined now by Haley Strack. She's a 2023 graduate of Hillsdale College and now William F. Buckley Fellow in Political Journalism at National Review. You can find her work at nationalreview.com. Haley, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Mr. Bertram.
Somehow after graduation, you found yourself at National Review and then found yourself writing a series of stories and essays in what I would call the energy and mining beat, somewhat unexpected coming from Hillsdale. And it all started with a trip down into a uranium mine. What was that like and how did that happen?
Yes, somehow, by the grace of God, I find myself at National Review and then 1,500 feet underground in Arizona. We have a longtime reader who manages an energy fuels resources mine. He is a, you know, communications director, so he reached out to the newspaper and a news editor, you know, I'm a few months into the job here at National Review. A news editor sent the pitch over to me and said, this seems like something you'd be interested in. He's a lovely news editor, great guy, but it was not, in fact, something I did think I'd be interested in. But, you know, I'm new to the job. I'll try out anything. I would love to know something about energy, especially as the world certainly seems oriented towards spending millions, billions of dollars and lots of time and, may I say, energy on clean goals and on renewables in the next or foreseeable future. So I said, okay, let's learn something. I called the Energy Fuels Resources, which is the parent company of Pinyon Plain Mine in Arizona. Energy Fuels has been in operation since the 80s. They were around before that, but they regrouped in the 2000s and geared up for this next fight in rare earths and critical minerals. They were saying, you know, we're ready to get back into the game. And so Curtis Moore of Energy Fuels Resources let me know that President Joe Biden was planning on declaring a national monument in Arizona, somewhat outside of the Grand Canyon. Anyone who's been there knows the value of that land. The Grand Canyon is beautiful. This mm-hmm. trip to the mine was the first time I've been myself, and I'm from California. But Grand Canyon National Park, the land surrounding, is gorgeous land. So, of course, any mining operations that might be going on in that land have always raised some red flags. We don't want anything to happen in the Grand Canyon. There are lots of Native American tribes around that area who have protested land designation for a while, or who have advocated for land designation for quite some time. So President Joe Biden was seeking to declare a new monument outside of the already millions of acres of land that the Grand Canyon National Monument protects.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Energy Fuels having a mine in this area, they were alarmed by this designation. What Joe Biden wanted to do and what he has, in fact, now done, what he completed in August, is cut off millions of acres of land to some of the United States' richest uranium deposits, which is a problem.
Yeah. You wrote about that, and then you wrote also about a threat in Utah as well to uranium mining there. We talk about energy independence. Why does squeezing our access to uranium affect it?
So our uranium control, our uranium production, our uranium refinement capability, they pale in comparison to other foreign counterparts that we are now competing with, not only in national defense, but also in energy and security. So Russia and China right now hold market dominance for both rare earths, critical minerals. So everything from uranium to the materials we need to produce lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, which, if you know anything about Joe Biden's recent campaigns, we're pushing electric vehicles like mad people. We want electric vehicles, but we have a very convoluted approach as to how to get there. Electric vehicles require massive amounts of energy, massive amounts of minerals
mm-hmm.
that the United States absolutely has in land deposits, but has no capability to mine. A part of the reason why is because, you know, decades ago, Russia, China, Uzbekistan, all of these places figured out that they could mine for very cheap. They could drive down market prices. In the United States, we are, you know, we love capitalism. We do love free trade. And we seize the opportunity to go outsource all of these markets and all of the rare earths we would need to places that could produce them for cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few problems with that. First, these places don't produce minerals in a safe way. The second problem, though, is that, you know, it's a national defense concern. We are now competing with Russia in the Russia-Ukraine war. If there ever comes a point in time when that war ramps up and we absolutely cannot go and outsource things to Russia, then we need to have some sort of dependence on the domestic market, which we do not. And our refinement capabilities will not be such until about 2030
mm-hmm.
when, Tesla's various projects that Elon Musk is starting in, I think, Texas, and we've got some in the mining belts in Alabama. Once those ramp up, then the U.S. will be in a good spot. But it's going to take a lot of time, and it's going to take a lot of power.
We go from uranium to lithium, and you wrote about a huge lithium deposit found in Nevada. Electric vehicles, need for lithium ion batteries. You think this would be a big cause for celebration. Was that actually the case?
Unfortunately, no. And I think you can see where this is going with Joe Biden's designation. One thing I want to mention about uranium, because it's similar with lithium, is that in Arizona, the uranium contained in the deposits that Joe Biden cut off are very valuable. And what I mean by that is that they contain like massive tons of ore. They contain massive tons of pure uranium per ton. Same with the lithium deposit in Nevada that we just found. So there are lots of lithium deposits everywhere. And again, the United States has just some of the richest land. You can see that with our national parks. It's a beautiful country. We know this, and with beautiful land. And the lithium deposit that we found in Nevada, not only is it massive, but it contains some of the best lithium we have. Unfortunately, some of the environmentalist groups and some of the Native American tribes that worked their hardest to cut off uranium mining in Arizona, I predict we'll try to do the same thing in Nevada. We'll see what Joe Biden does now.
And then you write about graphite, and I don't even know why we need graphite, but I read and it's used for battery paste and things like that, and China is now cracking down on the export of graphite to other places across the country. How will graphite help determine our energy future?
Oh, that is such a good question. Well, this is really the push-pull game with China here, and this is where we can see all of the different energy policies in effect. This is why we can see why we need to reduce our dependence so heavily, because China controls the graphite market. And when I say controls, I really mean control, or lithium, for uranium. There are some other countries that we can go to, Canada namely. But China, I think, altogether with refinement production, export, they contain maybe more than 90% of the graphite market. So we do need graphite, probably not for things that are as important as, you know, our rockets or our lithium ion batteries, but we do need graphite. And China just tightened market exports because we're tightening their control on semiconductor chips for national security purposes. We don't want China to have access to these semiconductor chips because they're very powerful. China, in return, cuts off graphite exports to the United States. This is set to go into effect in December. The problem here is that China could very easily do this on every other aspect of the market. China really does control most of the rare earths market. And if they do that, you know, again, the United States does not have the infrastructure to keep up. So we are now trying to shore up some different graphite resources in other places. Unfortunately, if we go to places like Africa for graphite, you get into regional disputes and you really don't know what'll happen if you seek out graphite in those areas. What I mean by regional disputes is that there are, unfortunately, some active, you know, either terror groups or groups that will seek to undermine what the United States can do in those mines. Again, as I mentioned, it's very unsafe, the mining conditions themselves. And then you have regional groups who come in and want to exploit what the U.S. is doing there. And so you don't know then how dependable that resource will be at the end of the day. You don't know, okay, well, will we have graphite in a few months? Who knows? Because we could not even be able to get to that land. We could not get it exported out. We don't know if people will be, you know, killing each other, which is, it's a very grim situation and one that the United States is now forced into because of China and because of our own reluctance.
Haley Strachey, 2023 graduate of Hillsdale College and current William F. Buckley Fellow in Political Journalism at National Review. Read everything we talked about at nationalreview.com. Haley, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Dr. Kevin Porteous from Hillsdale's Politics Department, J. Michael Waller, and Haley Strack, 2023 graduate of Hillsdale. The Radio Free Hillsdale Hour is recorded at the studios of WRFH, the student-run radio station at Hillsdale College. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at podcast.hillsdale.edu or wherever you get your audio. The assistant producer of the program is Sam Lair. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
When it comes to dinner, you're looking for tasty, flavor, ample portions, choices, and great value in a cozy, clean, family-friendly environment. Guests tell us our home-style dinners deliver on all counts. Whether you choose chicken fried steak, house-made meatloaf, roasted turkey, or slow-cooked pot roast, you'll be full and satisfied in the best way possible. So make Black Bear Diner your January comfort dinner destination. Open daily at 2605 Hilltop Drive, Reading.
Black Bear Diner.
Alan Gordon, Coachmaster Collision. Although Coachmaster is recognized as the authority and specialist in frame and suspension, we are primarily your auto body and truck collision repair center. This includes all vehicles, Lexus, Honda, or pickup trucks. Our technicians are highly trained and have the most advanced equipment to ensure a complete and quality repair. With our knowledge and the insurance claim process, all we need is your claim number to handle your claim. Coachmaster has a great working relationship with all insurance companies. This ensures a complete repair with quality parts and a delay-free process. At Coachmaster, in our 50 years in business, we've experienced almost every situation imaginable in a claim. This experience and personal dedication to the repair of your vehicle sets Coachmaster apart from all other choices. And yes, if we can't fix it, no one can.
Learn more online at CoachmasterAutobody.com.
At Cornerstone Community Bank, you're more than just a customer. You're our friends, neighbors, the local businesses where we shop, and the restaurants where we dine. Your success strengthens our community. Come meet our amazing teams in Reading, Red Bluff, and our newest location in Anderson. And find out why we are more than banking. Cornerstone Community Bank.
Member FDIC and Equal Housing Lender.
This is Carl Bott and Ted Leidy. We want to invite you to our new show, Man Up, the fourth Thursday of each month, right here on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM.
Man Up, 6 to 7 p.m., where we explore the lost art of being a man.
Spirits, cigars, and hit the ground running when you get up in the morning. That's what Man Up's going to be about.
Oh, don't forget motorcycles, guns, and hard work every day.
And those things that men talk about when women aren't around.
That's right. Even cooking sometimes.
People, places, and things.
Serving your family, your community, and your country.
Man Up. Fourth Thursday of each month from 6 to 7 p.m. right here on Free Fire Radio.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.